From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Many millennials who are coming of age in the era of hashtag MeToo and the pushback to rampant sexism in the White House, Congress, Hollywood, and America in general are likely identifying as feminists for the first time. It is indeed a good time to be a feminist. But there have been multiple waves of major feminist organizing over modern American history, and yet patriarchal power persists. What if it continues to persist after this latest awakening? Today, we'll turn to a longtime feminist, academic, author, and activist, Cynthia Enloe, whose lifetime of work offers lessons for challenging sexism, misogyny, and patriarchy on a global scale. Cynthia Enloe is a research professor at Clark University, specializing in critical studies of militarism and transnational feminism. She's appeared on the BBC, Al Jazeera, and NPR, and has written for Ms. Magazine and The Village Voice. She's the author of more than 15 books, including Maneuvers, The International Politics of Militarizing Women's Lives, and The Curious Feminist, Searching for Women in a New Age of Empire. She was awarded the Howard Zinn Lifetime Achievement in Peace Studies Award from the Peace and Justice Studies Association, and she now joins me to discuss her newest book. It's called The Big Push, Exposing and Challenging the Persistence of Patriarchy. Welcome to the program, Cynthia.
Hey, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, what jumped out at me right away is how your approach to challenging patriarchy is so global, so intersectional. And of course, your work in transnational feminism is obviously that way. But why is that so important? When you open your book talking about the Women's March, you don't just focus on the Women's March in DC or all of the women's marches in the US, but the women's marches that took place all over the world. This was the first one last year.
Yes, I think over the years, I've been very lucky to be taught, if you will, by activists, feminist activists especially, all over the world. And one of the things that is so risky about being an American, there are many ways in which it's risky being an American, but one of the ways is that you begin to think that Americans, whether they're Trumpists or feminists or in any sector of society, are somehow ahead of the pack, are out in front, are the pioneers, are the people in the forefront. And I've just been taught by so many feminists in different countries to be constantly not just humble. Well, humble is good. Humility is a core value of being a feminist, I think. But to be, if you're humble, it means you listen. It means you think, oh, you mean that's what women in Belgrade, in the former Yugoslavia, that's what they would march for last January. Or, oh gosh, you mean that's what's on the minds of the Swedish feminists who marched last year? Or that's how Chinese feminists have to approach the Women's March. And that's, I think, it's very helpful to not put the United States in the center of the universe. You have to stay curious about the United States, particularly if you live here and are trying to be part of the resistance here. But you can't put it in the center of the universe. It makes, I think it makes one dumb, actually.
Certainly internationalism and the common ground that we find with women elsewhere challenges U.S. militarism, right?
Yes, indeed. In fact, so much of the work that I do in other countries is with feminists who are telling me, here's how militarism is creeping or leaping ahead in our country. And then they immediately follow up. And this is the ways in which, even if you don't follow it in the United States, United States policy is enhancing that militarism.
How do you view what we have seen unfolding in the United States since maybe around the candidacies of Trump and Clinton to the election, the Women's March, and this past year, the Harvey Weinstein revelations, the hashtag MeToo movement? It seems like the possible beginning of the next wave of feminist organizing.
Yes, it's always interesting, isn't it, Sonali, to think about these waves. And I think about them not because they've got they started on Tuesday and they ended the next Thursday. They're never waves, or they start way out in the ocean and they lap way up on the shore. But it does say that we all have to keep renewing our feminist energy. We have to keep reviving and deepening our feminist curiosity. And it's the combination of curiosity and energy that makes a wave. And we are constantly discovering new things. And I think the great advantage of the Me Too movement now, which of course the hashtag Me Too was started by an African American woman. She's the first one who coined that.
Yes, Tarana Burke, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And who was it that took her to the Golden Globes as their special guest?
One of the Hollywood actresses whose name I can't remember.
I can't remember whether it was Reese Witherspoon or who it was, but I thought that was a very good reminder that, again, it wasn't white women in Hollywood who thought up hashtag Me Too. But one of the great advantages of this new energy and this new curiosity is we're looking deep into institutions. We're looking into the Ford auto plant in Detroit to see how sexual harassment operates in the lives of African-American and other women working in the Ford motor plant today in Detroit. But we're also looking at advertising agencies, not to mention, of course, the film industry, but also ballet companies, it turns out, and media companies, both radio and television. But it's not just in the celebrity world. And we're being much more curious now about every kind of institution and every kind of workplace. And I think while asking about how sexism operates in the workplace is itself not brand new, women in the 1900s and even in the 1880s and 90s were talking about that. But we have a new sense of urgency, and we have a new sense that we have to look at all industries. And that I think will carry us forward if we keep up our curiosity.
How important is it for us to identify the system we live in as patriarchy? Many young feminists may not really, you know, they might have heard the word, but may not really understand what it means. You know, this is, it's a very systemic, it's a big word. It's a word that encompasses a lot of big, broad things. So why is it important to use that? And how do you explain it?
Well, I think I use it. Well, first of all, I didn't used to use it. I used to think it was big and scary, actually. I thought it was abstract. I thought it was too big a concept to really capture the minutiae of sexism in everyday life. And I think what's new for me, and that's the reason that I decided to write The Big Push, was to really look at the minutiae of patriarchy in everyday life and how it gets updated, how it gets modernized, how it even is made hip. So I use patriarchy now not as a big sledgehammer, but as a very, very sharp scalpel to look at everything from who does the dishes and who is proud of having done the dishes three holidays in the year, but also how does Wall Street operate and how does Silicon Valley operate? I'm very interested in Silicon Valley startups and how patriarchy is made to look hip in the newest technology workplaces. So patriarchy is not big and it's big, but it's not abstract. It is as mundane as any form of sexism that silences women and silences those men who would like to have a different way of being a man and are embarrassed into keeping quiet about that.
And so this allows us to link, this term allows us to link so many seemingly disparate issues so that we can challenge everything from workplace harassment and sexual assault to, you know, things like the number of or lack of women in Congress. But also hopefully see militarism as part of patriarchy. And I want to focus on some of the very specific things you discuss in your book. You write about Syria and Syrian women, and your chapter in the book entitled Syrian Women Resist Peace Table Patriarchy was so fascinating. Tell me a little bit about why Syrian women have an important lesson in feminism for us.
Well, I think the first thing that I have to admit is that while I've studied wars and war zones and have spent a lot of time with women who've survived in war zones, I really didn't know how international peace negotiations happen. I didn't know who decides who's at the table, who gets invited, who doesn't get invited, what's the agenda, who decides on the agenda, what's considered an agreement, what happens after the agreement, who shakes hands with whom. And so I was invited by the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, which is sometimes called WILF, which is the first transnational women-led peace organization created in 1915, right in the middle of World War I, the horrors of World War I. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom was founded, and it's still very active in, I think, 60 different countries, including the U.S. And they held a alternative summit in Geneva at the very time when, I think it's called Geneva II, this is all diplomatic speak, right? Geneva I, Geneva II, Geneva III, those are all failures. So we have to go on to four and five. I think we're up to four now. But they decide to hold an alternative parallel summit of women peace activists to critique and reveal what happens at peace negotiations that make them so patriarchal. And one of the things I learned from everybody who was there, there were Northern Irish peace activists there, there were Southern Sudan peace activists, Sri Lankan. These are all people who have, women who have tried to create peace in their own countries. And one of the things they said is the profound fallacy, and it's a fallacy that is adopted even by people who are working for peace but have no feminist curiosity. And that's the fallacy of imagining that the only effective peace negotiations can take place amongst the men who have guns or the men who control guns. They may not wear the gun at their hip, but they're the one who authorized the sales of guns. And that those are the only people that are worth having at a peace negotiation table. And what all these feminists from Northern Ireland and other countries that have been through peace negotiations, former Yugoslavia, for instance, what they all said is, how can anyone imagine that the men who have guns and sell guns and control guns are the best people to imagine and create peace? They don't have any experience in it. They don't know how to think about peace. And it really takes women who are active in women's civil society groups that amazingly stay active during the worst of war. They're the ones who should be at the peace table. They're the ones who can really imagine what peace is like. And they try to actually create peace in little pockets sometimes, but they create peace in the middle of war. And that's what these Syrian women who managed to get out of Syria to come and take part in this discussion. And by the way, they then turned around and went back. Now that's courage. They managed to get out, and yet they were so dedicated to continuing their peace work in Syria that at the end of this meeting in Geneva, they went back to keep doing the work. And they said, this is absolutely true. We need women who are active in women's civil society groups to be at the peace table. They're the experts on making peace.
This reminds me so much about the work that Afghan women have done. I've done a lot of work with Afghan women, and it's the same story of Afghan women wanting to be at the peace table, but usually being left out because it's the armed men who have all the power who are brought in to do the negotiating, and the women who keep the peace are left out. So it's definitely a similar story. And of course, U.S. militarism fosters all of that, that status quo.
Yes, empowering men. U.S. militarism is oftentimes thought to be the basis for expertise in peace. One has, as a feminist, one knows one should be very, very wary about anyone who calls themselves an expert.
You have a chapter in your book entitled When Carmen Miranda Returns. This was a really fascinating story that goes back to a book that you had written, Bananas, Beaches, and Bases. Tell us about that book and why it's still relevant.
Well, I wrote that book, the first edition, the new edition. I had to totally rewrite it, which was quite an education, and that's when Carmen Miranda returns. Carmen Miranda is on the cover of both the first edition and this new edition because she taught me about bananas and about the history of gender and bananas. And the gendering of bananas was quite new to me. I'd grown up listening to Chiquita Banana sing, you know, Chiquita Banana, and I come to say, remember, that's how we all learned not to put bananas in the refrigerator, right? Carmen Miranda was the Hollywood celebrity associated with bananas. She herself came from Brazil. She was already a national figure in Brazilian entertainment before she came up to New York in 1940 and then was taken out to Hollywood, where she became a screen star. And she wore those, you probably have seen photographs of her, those enormous headdresses. I mean, I don't know how she kept it on, but those enormous headdresses of fruits on her head. And she said she adopted that headdress, which became her kind of telltale wardrobe. She adopted that headdress because that's what the market women up in Bahia in northern Brazil wore. And she, those were Afro-Brazilian women. And she was very inspired not only by their costumes, but also by their music. And one of the stories that I love about Carmen Miranda is when she came to Hollywood, the Hollywood producers and also the New York theater producers tried to persuade her. She was European in her heritage. So she was a Brazilian, a European Brazilian. But she had a Afro-Brazilian band that was her main band. And the New York producers and the Hollywood producers tried to persuade her to give up her Black Brazilian band because that wouldn't work in 1940s American media. And she said she wouldn't. She said, that's my inspiration. That is my band. You want me, you get my band as well. But she also made me think about where are women in the banana industry? And I'm still very interested in that. I follow bananas, tea, coffee, pineapples, sugar, always sugar. You always should follow sugar. I follow all those big plantation crops, and I want to know where are the women. And in the banana industry, what I found was that women were brought in to wash the bananas. Now, that may sound very benign on a banana plantation. They're usually not the workers that the banana companies hire to use their big machetes to trim the trees and chop down the big, what they call hands. A banana cluster is called a hand, I learned. They're in the washing sheds, and you, that sounds rather benign. But what I learned from listening to women telling the story of what it was like or what it is like to wash bananas is you're standing in pesticides all day. Because what are you washing off the bananas? You're washing off the bananas, all the pesticides that have been used on those bananas. And this is a double story of patriarchy, and it really the things that taught me about where to look for patriarchy in a big transnational food product like bananas. And what these women told me was that in the big labor unions, which were very important in revolutions in Central America, the big banana worker labor unions, they were all male-led. And it was the men, the working men in the banana industry who thought they knew what banana workers needed, and they were the ones to lead the labor movement against the big banana companies like Del Monte and Chiquita and Dole. Those are the three international biggies. And the women in the sheds said, wait just a minute now. We have things to say about the banana industry. We have things to say about what workers need. We have things to say about justice. We have knowledge. We have knowledge that unions need. And they began organizing in the 1990s and early 2000s, starting in Honduras. And they've now become a major force in the banana labor unions transnationally. And here's one of the things, Sonali, they've done recently. They've said, you can't talk about workers' rights on a banana plantation unless you talk about sexual harassment. The men who led the big, otherwise seemingly very progressive banana worker unions, they had never raised the question. Well, they never raised the question about childcare. They'd never raised the question about health. But they certainly hadn't raised the question about sexual harassment. And so I thought that was really important to underscore, to understand the international politics of food, product by product, because it won't be exactly the same in coffee as it is in bananas, and it won't be the same in sugar as it is in coffee. So you have to be very curious about the particular product and then listen to women.
Right. So capitalism, labor, food, the food industry, all intertwined with how patriarchy persists globally. I want to ask you, Cynthia, how you explain to a young feminist that all of the feminist organizing that has happened both in the United States and globally seems to have not tackled patriarchy strongly enough. We see the fact that patriarchy persists, and we perhaps take for granted the successes of feminist organizing. But 10, 20, 30, 50 years ago, things were, in many cases, much worse, right?
Yes, some things have gotten worse, on the other hand. I think in some ways, the garment industry is worse than ever. And I'm very interested in the garment industry in, for instance, Bangladesh. But two things about a feminist who has sort of seen a lot, been around a lot, thought a lot, and had a chance to experience several generations. The very first thing is never, ever, ever be the smug feminist. Ever. Never be the one who's been around and can lecture to this person who's becoming a feminist about, you know how it is. So the first thing is anti-smugness, you know, should be right up in the forefront. The other thing is, just because patriarchy has persisted doesn't mean that we should be cynical or depressed, because the reason that patriarchy has persisted is it's adaptable. That is, it has suffered setbacks. It has suffered defeats. It has given up. It gave up the male-only vote. It has given up on a number of its cherished practices, but it's then had to regroup and rethink and become more creative. These are people, I shouldn't just say patriarchy as if patriarchy is an actor. It's everybody who benefits from patriarchy. And that's most men, but not all men, most men and surprising number of women who believe they gain from a patriarchal way of doing things and thinking. So I think that we, as collectively around the world, we've had some great successes. The very fact that we're having this conversation, you and I, the very fact that you're on the air, you know, that's a success.
And a proudly women-run show.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's not nothing, you know. That wasn't true in the early days of television.
Yeah.
Or radio. So I think that those are successes. What I think I'm more impressed with and trying to think about myself is how adaptable patriarchy is, how it, not automatically, but how people who benefit from patriarchy are constantly trying to update their language, try to look more hip, try to look more progressive, try to look more modern, in order to handle all our successes. So we've got them on the run, but we have to not stop running, not stop thinking, not stop investigating, not stop organizing.
It's interesting, a lot of us might want to separate out tackling workplace harassment from militarism abroad, might want to separate out the issue of sexual violence with the labor organizing and the ravages of capitalism, but they are all linked, and I think we see those links to our benefit. This idea of tackling patriarchy, I'm wondering, Cynthia, finally, if you think we need to, this is an issue I've been thinking a lot about, and when I've been looking at the hashtag MeToo movement, one of the things that occurred to me was that we do need to root our struggle in the fight for gender justice. I don't know if that's broad enough to fit patriarchy, but gender justice, a sort of affirmative or positive thing that we are fighting for, as opposed to this thing that we're fighting against. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Yes, I think it's always a dilemma for any organizing, isn't it? You see the links, and the more you see the links, the more paralyzed you feel, because you think, oh my God, I'm just trying to tackle sexual harassment in the workplace. Just, I mean, that's huge, right? I mean, there's so many places. I mean, hotels are sources of sexual harassment for cleaners in hotels. You know, I mean, just tackling sexual harassment in the workplace seems enormous because you have to think about the Bangladeshi garment workers. Don't imagine that they're just subjects of capitalism. They're subjects of daily sexual harassment as well. And then you say, oh my God, but that's also linked to the causes for environmental degradation, which are based on not paying attention to women's knowledge of safe environments. And that's also linked to what drives militarism, which is this overpowering, for some men anyway, need to be in control of violence, all kinds of violence. And you think, well, I just can't tackle all of those. And I think the answer is, don't try, think about all of them. Think about the links about between them. Try to become as educated as you can about the links, which usually means reading about the lives of other women. But then try to organize where you can make a difference, but link your organization to other kinds of organizing. So to organize against military bases that the United States, and not just the United States, has in many countries. Organize against military bases because they're always exploitative of the environment and of women. At the same time as you root your own effort where you think you can make the difference in your neighborhood, in your workplace, in your demographic community. But make the link. Don't think you have to do it all yourself, but you do have to think about them, the links. But don't get paralyzed.
So broaden your analysis while keeping activism narrow, perhaps, so that it's doable and obtainable.
Yeah, I would say focused.
There you go. Rather than narrow. Well, yeah. Cynthia, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, sharing your expertise with us, and good luck with the new book.
Oh, thanks, Sonali. It was great talking to you.
My guest has been Cynthia Enloe, research professor at Clark University, specializing in critical studies of militarism and transnational feminism. She's the author of more than 15 books. We've just been discussing her latest book. It's called The Big Push, Exposing and Challenging the Persistence of Patriarchy. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.